Every link in our food chain is governed, to one extent or another, by the cost of hydrocarbon energy. The cost of this energy is going through the roof. The price of oil, for but one example, is now approaching $100 per barrel, whereas 20-some years ago, it was only $10 per barrel. Clearly, we must find a way to produce cheaper energy from hydrocarbons if we are continue to live in the manner to which we have become accustomed. And so today we pause to ask, how can we produce cheaper energy from hydrocarbons?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 572nd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Pizza who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
And producers Carol Stafford and Harmley Taff are out in the field today. Folks, it's a fact. 86% of the energy we use to grow, process, package, and ship food comes from deposits of hydrocarbons stored within the Earth's crust. Unfortunately, we do not own the crust within which is stored most of that hydrocarbon energy, so we must buy the hydrocarbons from others who are now charging us quite literally an arm and a leg. To continue living the grand lifestyle to which we have become accustomed, we simply must find a way to produce cheaper energy from hydrocarbons. And so we ask, how can we produce that cheaper energy? Here to help us explore this question, we have Juan Enriquez. Juan, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you very much.
So let me ask you before we go quickly to where you come from. Do you think we can produce cheaper energy from those hydrocarbons?
I think so. You know, we're clearly going to have to come up with a different way of both consuming and producing energy, and hopefully within the next 10 years,
and
we'll
soon,
be making
right?
a series of choices between wind and between solar and perhaps nuclear and a series of other things. But between the point where we can make those choices and today, the real option happens to be hydrocarbons, which are oil, gas, and coal.
Mm-hmm.
And those actually turn out to have a lot to do with food.
And do you think that we can actually find a way of producing energy more efficiently from hydrocarbons?
Well, I think one of the things we should explore in this program is how what happened in agriculture is going to start happening in energy.
Okay, good. Let me go back to your to who you are, Juan, so people can get a better idea of with whom we're talking today. I saw a op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal by Juan some time ago, and I just fell in love with it, and I thought, boy, this is a person that we need to talk to. Juan is quite a character. He's a founder of the Harvard Business School's Life Science Project. He's a co-founder of Synthetic Genomics, and he's also the managing director of Excel Medical Ventures. So, Juan, what do you do in your spare time?
Oh, I've been extraordinarily lucky. I've had a life that's allowed me to combine interest in academia and research with sailing around the world looking for new species and being able to fund new companies.
So you're a biologist, correct?
I'm actually quite confused. I started out and finished political philosophy and economics and government, and then I started out and finished business and international finance, and then I started getting interested in an obscure area called genomics a while ago. Which is trying to figure out what the order of letters that codes for all life forms is.
Ah.
So we are all made of a substance called DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And that substance has four basic chemicals in it: adenine, theanine, guanine, cytosine, which people know as ATCG. And if you think of a human being, every one of your R cells has about 6.4 billion letters of code in it. And that's our entire human genome. It's the program that makes our stomachs and our brains and our toes and our smiles and a whole bunch of other stuff.
And everything.
And we have 100 trillion copies of all of that program in each of our cells. So each of our cells, with the exception of some blood cells, contains our entire program. And in the same way as if you put a DVD or a movie into your computer or into your player, it will play that movie or it'll play that DVD or it'll execute a program, a Google or a Explorer or something else. That's the same way that bodies work. And this has just been an incredible year for biology, because just as Einstein in 1905 wrote these incredible series of three articles that fundamentally changed our thoughts about space and time and the universe, last year was an absolute miracle year for biology.
Because we did what?
Well, there's about 5 or 6 critical papers that were published last year. And they're really going to change the way that we live, and particularly the way our kids live. So one of the papers shows that you can take a cell and undifferentiate it, which means that you can turn it into a cell that hasn't been programmed. Let me get a little more specific on that. When your mother and father conceive you, they bring together half of their gene code and mix it together, and out comes one of us. And what's happening is each of our cells contains all of that gene code. But as those cells divide, the first cell, which is a fertilized female egg, then divides into 2 cells, and that divides into 4, and that divides into 8. And for the first 16 divisions, those cells are what we call pluripotent, which means they can become absolutely any part of your body. After 16 divisions, each of your cells still contains all of your genes, but they become skin, or they become bone, or they become eyes, or they become stomach.
They get their directions then.
And if they don't do that, then they become cancerous.
Oh.
So if you think of a cancerous tumor, a tumor is really a whole bunch of different body parts growing without control somewhere in your body. And instead of growing in an orderly fashion, you get this big lump of junk that eventually kills you if you don't stop it. So there's some really interesting questions sitting in there, and one of the papers on the one hand showed you how you can turn a differentiated cell into an undifferentiated cell, which means you don't have to get stem cells from embryos anymore. You can get them from any part of your body.
So biology is undergoing this tremendous revolution then, and is happening right here underneath our feet, as it were.
Well, what's really interesting these days is it's not just biology. See, while we're arguing about Iraq, and we're arguing about presidential candidates, and we're arguing about all kinds of stuff, what we're doing, and what people have to understand, and particularly in the region of the country that you're in, because that's actually one of the most interesting places to sit these days. There's some really smart people wandering around California. And about 90% of the scientists that have ever lived are alive today. And we are going to double the amount of data generated by all human beings across all time over the next 5 years. So there's this incredible explosion in biology, in robotics, in nanotechnology, in communications. A whole series of really interesting things are happening out there. And very often we focus on the headlines of the newspapers, but not really on the stories that change things across decades or centuries.
And so we're on the verge of something very big. Is that what you're saying?
It's already happened. I mean, that's what's so interesting. You know, we all grew up, you know, with these visions of the Jetsons and robots and all these robots that were supposed to be there. And well, we've been promised robots that interact with us for so long that we've gotten really cynical because it was just around the corner and just around the corner. Mm-hmm. And now what you're beginning to find, there's a guy out there in California called Paul Saffo, who's just a very smart guy. And one of the things he started studying is how do people interact these days with machines?
And we're going to have to pick that up when we come back from the break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Juan Manriquez, and we're talking about technology and whether we can use it to get more from hydrocarbon energy. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Juan Enriquez, who is, gosh, he's almost everything. Founder of Harvard Business School's Life Science Project, co-founder of Synthetic Genomics, and managing director of Excel Medical Ventures. And today we're talking about the possible use of technology, the new technologies that are being developed and have been developed. To take old technology like the extraction of energy from hydrocarbons and seeing if we can be more efficient at it and in the end make what we have go farther and cost less. And there have been a lot of technological developments in the last few years, and they seem to be compounding themselves, and we're having a great time doing it. Right, Juan?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really wonderful time because we have so many different instruments and options and opportunities. I mean, you can look at the future as Malthus did and think that, you know, everything's going to hell in a handbasket and there's nothing we can do about it.
Or
you can look at this as, yes, there are huge problems and we commit absolutely huge mistakes. But overall, the picture has been quite a positive picture. There are more people that are eating better on this planet mm-hmm. than ever before. There are less percentage of people dying of famines than ever before. There are actually even less wars than traditionally have been out there.
It's hard to believe, but it's probably true,
energy,
yeah.
Food systems. There's a lot of problems, but there's stuff we can do about it.
Well, let's turn to energy right now, which seems to be one of our big problems because 86% of the energy that we use comes from hydrocarbons, and most of those hydrocarbons are underneath the feet of somebody else, correct?
Yep.
So tell us a little bit from what are hydrocarbons? Pretend like I have no idea what they are. What are they?
You know, the irony of this thing is there's still a debate as to exactly what oil is and what gas is and what coal is and where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. And those are the three forms of hydrocarbon we use for energy, correct?
Correct. So even though we've been using this stuff and studying it for centuries, there's still debates as to what it is. Now, our best guess at this point, and the place where most people sit, is that hydrocarbons are organic compounds. And that means that they come from something that was living as opposed to something that's mineral.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of it in those terms, one of the ways that we think you get oil is you take a bunch of plants or you take a bunch of bacteria or fungi or whatever and you rot it under pressure for billions of years. And once you do that, it becomes this black gunk soup called oil. And then if you compress it and burn it, it becomes coal. And if it continues to rot, then it becomes gas. So if you think of it in those terms, then oil, gas, and coal all come from things like plants.
Mm-hmm. From life.
And if you think of plants, then next time you look at a palm tree, think of it as a basically a big stand that holds a whole bunch of solar panels called leaves. So the way the plant powers itself is it takes the sun's energy and absorbs a lot of the sunlight. And the excess energy left in that plant either can be burned when we put it into a fireplace, or if it stays and rots, then it can become something like oil. So if you think of it in those terms, oil is concentrated sunlight.
Right. And traditionally, we have extracted the energy from coal by burning it, correct?
Correct.
From oil by distilling gasoline out of it, correct?
Yep.
And from gas by pretty much by just by burning it.
Yep.
What and those are essentially when we look at gasoline, for example, that's kind of a chemical process, correct?
Right. So what you're doing is you're spending an awful lot of money to go and find a pile of bacterial and plant soup, which you then pump up to the surface, which you then put into a pipeline and transport for a long distance, which you then put into a series of refineries, which are basically cracking units.
What is cracking?
It's a process that it's a little bit like sorting and harvesting corn. So eventually what you want to get to is the corn kernel. But to get there, you've got to go through a whole process of picking the thing and cutting the stalks and stripping off the leaves and taking it off the cob so that you get the kernels. And you're basically doing the same thing with oil. There's a whole series of compounds that come out of the oil. And what cracking does is it separates those compounds and puts them into different uses.
Mm-hmm.
So a refinery will typically produce some lubricants, or it can produce some compounds used for paints, or it can produce some stuff used for various solvents, or it can produce stuff used for gasoline or whatever else.
Now, you write about making a transition from being from using these chemical technologies to using biological technologies to extract energy more efficiently. What exactly do you mean there?
Well, think about what happened in agriculture and how we went about agriculture. The whole reason why we have civilization, and people like Jared Diamond have written far more literate stuff on it than I, is basically because you learned how to generate excess calories, which meant excess food.
Mm-hmm.
Most animal species spend most of their time trying not to get eaten, trying to find enough to eat, trying to sleep, and trying to reproduce. And the reason why we have the leisure time to participate in school or politics or religion or knowledge or art or war or any other human endeavor is because there's enough to eat for the most of us.
Here on the food chain, we like to say that agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
Exactly. And that's absolutely right, because if you didn't have excess calories, then, you know, the first effect is we wouldn't have as many fat people. But the second effect would
be we wouldn't have as many skinny people either.
Have a civilization. Simply because we'd be so busy hunting and gathering that we wouldn't have time for anything else.
Right.
And that's what happens to an awful lot of species. But once you get to the point where you generate enough calories, you have to think about how you do that. For most of time, what we did is we used brute force. So we plowed the earth first with our plows and then by harvesting animals and then by having machines do it. And then we discovered chemicals, so we started using pesticides and fertilizers and herbicides and all kinds of stuff. And then we discovered transport mechanisms. So we started using silos, and we started using conveyor belts, and we started using food processing operations. So we got very sophisticated, but most of the way in which we produced and processed food was brute force. Bigger combines, bigger tractors, bigger silos, bigger farms, bigger irrigation systems, bigger dams. And what happened in the 1960s in agriculture is we completely changed the paradigm. There was a man, a wonderful man, called Norman Borlaug, who was doing some research down at an organization called CIMMYT in Mexico. And he discovered a way of programming seeds using genetics to produce an awful lot more food out of the same parcel of land. And that's what we call the Green Revolution. And Borlaug is one of the world's true heroes because he's the person who basically ended the constant famines that used to wash across India, that used to wash across China, that used to wash across great portions of the world. Because in essence, he taught us how to grow food on the same parcel with less, not using as much brute force and mechanical input. So it was genetics that really led to the food surpluses that we saw until very recently.
And genetics is where we're going to go after we return from this break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Mike Lawson here with Juan Enriquez, and we're talking about using technology to get more from the hydrocarbon energies which we rely on to power our world. We're going to pick up phones when we come back from this break as well. The phone numbers today, if you care to join us, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Do pick your phones up and join us. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Well, can we produce energy more efficiently from the hydrocarbons than we have in the past using the new technologies that have been developed and are being developed in the world of science? We have Juan Enriquez with us. Juan, you were talking a little bit about this transition that's being made from, I guess, old world technologies of brute force and chemicals to this new world technology that includes the manipulation of genes, correct?
Correct. So in the same way as agriculture moved from brute force towards genetics, you're going to start seeing the same thing apply to oil and gas. And let me give you a couple of examples because this sounds very exotic, but we're already seeing it. If oil is concentrated sunlight, and if oil comes mostly from plants, we can short-circuit the process of producing energy from plants, and we already do that with things like ethanol. So we already know that we can grow gasolines out of plants using sugar cane or sugar beet or corn or cellulose or a series of other things. And if you can produce gasoline coming out of a plant, then you can produce virtually any petrochemical derivative.
Anything that is being derived from petroleum should be able to be derived from plants.
Correct. And so part of what's happening here is there's a series of companies that are sick and tired of very high oil prices that vary a lot. And what they're doing is they're programming bacteria to produce plastics. So instead of producing plastics out of a bacteria, out of an oil plant, you process the oil and you get gasoline, you get plastic. What you're doing today is you're programming bacteria to make those plastics. Now, the interesting thing about that is not only are you able to produce plastics without having to buy from the Middle East, but you're able to produce plastics that are made as you wish them to be made. So it's like following a different recipe.
Making your own recipe.
Because you're programming the recipe, then one of the things that you can do is you can make those plastics biodegradable. One of the problems that we've got in this world is that plastics very often don't biodegrade for a long, long, long time. And if you can program those plastics, then you can get your little plastic water bottles that you take to the beach. But 6 months after you put them into a landfill, they will disappear and there will no longer be plastic. And that's a much more friendly environmental way of taking it.
And
the next time you go shopping at one of these food chains.
It should be noted, too, that you're not talking theoretical things here. You're talking about things that companies are already doing, correct?
Correct.
Give us the example that you quote about DuPont.
Well, DuPont has sold off most of its traditional petrochemical areas. DuPont, as most of our listeners know, used to make a lot of the original nylons and polyesters and all kinds of things that, you know, sit inside rugs or sit inside the new whiz-bang jackets that you use that help you run in bad weather, or stuff you use in surfboards or stuff that you use for swimming, or just your t-shirts. And most of that stuff used to come from things like petrochemicals. Today what's happening is we're able to program bacteria as we program computers to make that kind of stuff. So DuPont has sold off its traditional petrochemical derivatives to the Saudi Arabian oil company, which has now moved that stuff over to Saudi Arabia and is making it with oil. And DuPont is making it with bacteria. And the new stuff that's coming out of this, you have t-shirts that feel like silk, but are biodegradable and have the same characteristics as polyester.
Wow.
You have polyesters for sports that breathe, that are an awful lot more comfortable to wear, and that are much more environmentally friendly.
So essentially, we're going back to our roots here, aren't we? I mean, a long time ago, we made clothes from hemp.
That's exactly right.
Plant fibers, and I guess we're going back to our roots of, you know, using plants for those things.
Well, see, that brings up some interesting questions, because farmers were really, for a long time, the servants of country folk, and they made them the wood, and they made them the textile, and they made them the food, and then gradually we quit using coal for the most part and wood to heat our homes, and we started using oil and gas and stuff, and the farm world was more and more focused on making food, often on bigger and bigger sort of large-scale commercial enterprises. What's happening today is you can program any life form, and that includes a bacterium, or that includes food, or that includes an animal, is you can program it for various purposes. And that means that, you know, every acre of land can be used to produce a grain, or can be used to produce organic vegetables, or can be used to produce energy, or can be used to produce textiles, or can be used to produce biodegradable plastics, or a whole host of other things. And it's going to be up to the farmer, the producer, what he or she chooses to do with his or her land, for what purpose. They have an awful lot more options today than they used to have.
Huh. Well, we're going to go to the phones right now. We have some questions and some comments. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. We have Juan Enriquez, and I am Michael Olson. We're going to go to Charles, who has a question about corn. You knew this one was going to come up. Charles, welcome to The Food Chain.
Howdy. I was listening to your show, and I remember when there was a big hoo-ha about Brazil going energy independent because of ethanol production. But they did it with sugarcane. And I remember President Bush actually going and visiting there, and then he came back and he goes, corn. And I went, what? We've got the Hawaiian Islands, and I've visited there a couple of times lately, and huge tracts of land lying fallow because all the food production has moved off the island. Why don't we use the Hawaiian Islands to grow sugarcane and use it for ethanol.
What about ethanol?
I think that's a far better idea than growing corn. The energy conversion ratio on corn, how much energy do you have to put in per gallon of gas that you get out, is actually very, very tight. And some people even argue it's
negative.
So you put in as much energy as you get out. And if you use sugarcane, I think that's a far more effective way of doing it. Problem in the United States is the first primary in the political season is not held in Hawaii, it's held in Iowa. And the second problem that you've got here is that the United States geography is not terribly adequate for sugarcane.
Except for Hawaii, which is a long ways away. We're going to have to take a quick break. Charles, can you hang on?
Sure.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, we're with Juan Enriquez, and we're going to take a quick break. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Do join us right back.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box. A heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Well, what do you think, folks? Do you think we can get more energy out of the hydrocarbons that we have for less cost? Maybe we can, given the new technologies being outlined by Juan and Enriquez here on The Food Chain. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, and you can join us if you so desire. Before we go back to the phones, Juan, I'd like to follow up on the ethanol question. It's long been argued that the corn ethanol program is kind of a political, I don't know, boondoggle maybe, because we're not getting much more energy than we're putting into the equation. But some say that the cellulosic ethanol has a lot of promise because it will deliver a lot more energy than we put in. But that we lack a scientific breakthrough or two to get to the point where we can actually develop cellulosic ethanol on a commercial scale. Do you have any comments with respect to that direction?
I think one of the things we should do is not pick winners and losers. I get very upset when we see huge bets and subsidies for specifically one technology or one area of the economy. That doesn't work for me. What I'd rather see is a much broader support for research and development. And I don't think that works terribly well, because I think what ends up happening is you end up favoring corn growers over people who are studying trees or cellulose,
right,
or something else. What I'd rather see, I think, is a set price for gasoline. Let me explain what I mean. Right now, gas is probably selling for, I don't know what it is out there, but it's quite expensive compared to what it was last year, and very expensive compared to what it was 2 years ago. If we set a minimum price that was 40% below where it is today, and simply said, if oil is $100 a barrel today, we will not allow oil to be sold in the United States for less than $60 a barrel. And that doesn't mean that we're going to pay $60 a barrel to to the Middle East. It simply means if the price of the Middle East comes below $60 a barrel, then that differential will be a tax.
So what you're saying is that
alternative energy research.
So what you're saying is that we're going to protect our researchers from the possibility of the Arabs lowering the cost of oil to $10 a barrel and undercutting them.
That's exactly right. And what you really want to do with this stuff is you want to tell people, if you're going to research corn or if you're going to research ethanol or something else, understand that it will not be less than $60 a barrel, because if you do that, what the traditional game in the Middle East has been is anytime anybody gets close to wind power or solar power or something else,
they lower the cost of oil.
They lower the price.
Yeah. In the 80s, they lowered it to $10 a barrel.
Right.
And they killed our oil industry.
Right.
Let's go quickly to Wayne, who has a question about sun energy. Wayne, welcome to the Food Chain.
Gentlemen, Wayne from Brookdale. Thank you for taking my call. Great topic. Yeah, when you mentioned that hemp shirts, that really gassed me a little. I can see Grandma doing my shirts, my hemp shirts. And then she says to me, what are all these holes in your hemp shirts here? Have you been smoking your shirts again? That's supposed to be funny, guy.
Okay.
Well, anyway, my question is slightly off topic, but I think it's rudimentary. We know stars burn hydrogen for energy. This is in reference to oil being liquid sunshine. We know that the stars burn hydrogen energy, and at some point they switch over to a helium burn, which would probably burn with less energy. And my question is, if our sun is pooping out, which I'm worried that it is, this is a strange, waiting for that planet warming, you know, that's supposed to show up. If our sun is pooping out, doesn't this kind of put the kibosh on all of this food conservation and energy conservation? Wouldn't we be out of the picture if our sun poops out?
Well, geez, I suspect we would be. What do you think, Juan?
You know, that's a concern that I'm going to have in about 500 million years.
Good. Me too. I'll worry about it in 500 million years. Let's go to Bill in Monterey with respect to the burning of coal. Bill?
Yeah, I was wondering, when you burn coal, there's radioactive elements in it. Is there any way, any process of getting the radioactive elements out of coal so that it isn't released in the atmosphere when it's burnt? And I think a lot of the other solutions, like solar or wind, is not possible to energize our country because of the vast amounts that we use. Do you agree?
Well, the thing that worries me more about coal than the radioactivity is how dirty a fuel it can be if you use it in things like gas-fired electric plants. That's actually the largest single source of greenhouse gases that are warming the planet today.
And I'd like to pick this up when we get back from our last break here, if we can. Can you hold on, Bill?
Sure.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to follow up with Bill on the burning of coal, which is an especially interesting subject because we are now a world in which is using a lot of coal, especially in China, and I believe India as well, because those are nations that are powering up, and they're using coal to do it. And so we ask, is there a more efficient way of getting energy from coal than simply burning it? And maybe our man, Juan Enriquez, will enlighten us. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. The phone number is today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We will get to the phones when we get back from these very important messages, so please do stay tuned. We're back. This is The Food Chain. We're talking about coal and figuring out if there's a more efficient way of getting energy from coal and burning it and making a mess in our atmosphere. Juan Enriquez, you write about the possibility of a different way of getting energy from coal. What is that?
Well, one of the things that coal mines generate is also gas. And so far we've seen that as a huge problem because
it blows up.
You read about miners that have been hurt by a coal gas explosion. But there are mines that have coal gas and there are mines that don't. And the difference between one mine and the other, I think, is bacteria eating coal and then doing the same thing that a child that eats a lot of beans does. A lot of beans generate a lot of gas. And a lot of bacteria generate a lot of gas as they eat the coal. So if we're able to fertilize coal, if we're able to do the same things we do in agriculture with energy, then we're going to get a much cleaner burning fuel without having to strip mine.
So in keeping with the theme, we're talking about growing bacteria that eat coal and then release gas that we capture and burn, which is much cleaner way of doing of burning coal, correct?
Correct, and I think we'll start doing that across energy. So as we think about how to take the sulfur out of oil, we will find sulfur eating bugs. As we think about working on how to get more energy out of plants, we will find bacteria that are both oxygen tolerant and oxygen and can live in a non-oxygen environment, and that will enormously increase the amount of ethanol that we can get out of sugarcane or out of cellulose or out of other things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole series of things coming where energy will become a lot more like agriculture.
Okay, Bill, quick follow-up.
Yeah, I was wondering, is there any way of getting the radioactive elements out of coal, even if you process a gas out of it? Are you going to get the radioactive elements out of it?
No, I don't think you will. I haven't studied the radioactive elements in coal or gas, but my impression is natural gas doesn't have the same issues. And if you leave the coal buried and simply consume the gas, then I think the issue that you're worried about will not be serious, if not, just go away.
Okay, let's go to Robbie, who has a question about energy from plants. Robbie, welcome to the food chain.
Good morning, Mike. Good program. Corn is reprehensible to use as a fuel when it's got a system for making food, and we've already seen food shortages and price increases in Mexico. So corn's out as far as I'm concerned. I don't believe in using it for ethanol. Sugarcane is very labor-intensive to harvest. We have a natural resource that is a pest and grows very, very rapidly and produces great biomass, and that is water hyacinth that chokes boat channels and fills in canals and everything else. And I think that would be an ideal plant mass to use to make ethanol and other fuels and plastics.
Juan?
Well, those are the kinds of questions that researchers are asking, and they're right along what we should be asking, which is, what's the best way of producing energy? Is it?
Yeah, so much easier to harvest water hyacinths. All you do is just go and scoop them up.
And, you know, there are people who argue the same thing for switchgrass. There are people who argue the same thing for jatropha. There's a whole series of things people are looking at, and that's why we need a stable price of oil and not to favor one plant over others or one plant over a bacteria.
There you go. Juan Enriquez, thank you so much for joining us today. What a pleasure. You are a great teacher.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.